The Millennial Express, ploughing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2023. I'm now here with Collective Dismal, who is a Canadian content creator. You did have a YouTube channel, but it was banned. Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah, so my channel originally was banned, but I've since made a new one, and I'm kind of clawing my way back up to the viewership. I'm about halfway to where I was. I capped out around 700. And unfortunately, you know, I'm not one of these guys that has, 50,000 Twitter followers but I had a very ambitious and fervent audience, and it's unfortunate, but we're set back and not deterred.
Right. I don't have the link for your new YouTube channel, I don't think. But if you can send that.
That's okay. Yeah.
I'll add it so that people can find it.
Sure.
Easily.
Yeah, Collective Dismal at YouTube.
Okay. So, and you're also on Telegram. You also post your videos too there. So, could you introduce yourself? But before we get to the channel, could you introduce yourself? Because this is, again, your debut on Millennial.
Yes. So, I would like, before I even introduce myself, I want to kind of do a preamble of what it means for me to be here, because there's a little sentimental value for me being here. So a couple of years ago, during the whole COVID pandemic, I was displaced from the job that I was working in, unfortunately, and I was forced to take a job quite a ways from my home and my family, a few hours away, and it was kind of a crummy job. The managers there were real ball busters, and the only perk was that I was able to listen to content. They allowed me to keep, you know, earplugs in while I was doing my thing. And I listened to Millennial that year, and it got me through the holidays. It was I listened to every minute of every second of it, and so it was, kind of surreal when you asked me to be on here. It's a very nostalgic thing for me that you do. So, a lot of appreciation and respect. I know the demands of it must be insane. So,
well. I get through it each year. It's funny that it's nostalgic because I guess it has been going for 9 years now. So that people will have memories associated with it from 5 years ago and 8 years
sure.
ago and so forth. So and indeed from 3 years ago with COVID. So it's interesting to me to hear how it fits into people's lives. As it was with my YouTube channel, I remember people would tell me that they listened to it like over breakfast or in the bath and stuff. It's very strange because obviously it's completely different for me. I'm not in all these different locations. I'm just here at home doing this, and it's funny how it reaches people in different ways.
Yeah,
but yeah, Millennial has become a thing in itself, really, at this point. So.
Yeah, it got me through a rough spot, so much appreciated. Hope it continues another 10 years and onward.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yep.
Those are kind comments, and I appreciate them. And I'm, as I say, I'm glad that it got you through a bad spell. So would you introduce yourself?
So I've been making content on YouTube primarily for coming up on a year now. And I've been following the content for many years prior to that. I speak on a very wide array of subject matter. I speak on anything from population control to eugenics. I speak on, I do a lot of anecdotes from my own experience with different jobs and navigating the job markets, stupid things that have happened to me. I try to keep some of the content funny and a little bit satirical. I put a lot of passion into it because no matter your message, you're going to have a little bit of charisma, or it doesn't matter what you have to say. And I do kind of think of myself a little bit as an amateur philosopher. You know, I talk a lot about different facets of that, which I feel are important not to be overlooked or downplayed. Ethics and, you know, different philosophies of mind, things like this. So I speak on a wide array, and people follow me for very different reasons. I speak a lot about ascetic practices, denial of gratification. I think that this is primarily the only thing that really sets man apart from animal, is his ability to defer gratification to the future. Some peoples are able to do this better than others, and I think all civilizations are predicated on such an ability. So I tell a lot of guys who follow me whose their, you know, neurological reward systems have been destroyed by TikTok, pornography, things like this, how they can begin to resensitize themselves to dopamine and things like that. So
all
that's
right.
Who I am. Yep.
I'm just finding your new channel so that I can link it to people.
Sure. Appreciate that.
So how did you get started with the channel, the project Collective Dismal, and what inspired the name?
Well, it was reluctance that got me kind of started. I wish somebody else would be here in my place saying the message, and I could just sit back and, you know, throw my eggs in their basket and say the deed is done. I don't think that people were necessarily getting to the root of a lot of the problems I see. It seemed everybody had a little piece of it, but there was something severely lacking. And I felt kind of forced into this position. So it's, I have like an insatiable wantingness to explain certain things that have happened in my life, which have fueled my curiosity. And I've never relented over the years, and I have come to some very unintuitive conclusions, which I think may shock some of the listeners at first. I know it definitely kind of knocked me off my feet for a while when I first started to reframe the situation in the way that I have. So,
well, please go into that, and also describe your political. I mean, I think you told me you're about 30 at this
point. Sure.
Describe your background, your political, so that we understand your political evolution, how you arrived at where you are now. Where did you begin? What was your family upbringing like?
Well, I was never one of these guys that was, you know, a quote unquote normie, and then, you know, COVID happened and it snapped me out of my stupor. I always had a little bit of a skeptical disposition about things. I was born, obviously, at the beginning of the 1990s, and you know, even growing up watching things like Fahrenheit 9/11 with Michael Moore, and it's, I always had this spirit of sort of questioning authorities. My greatest strength is that I've been very open to listen to anybody. I'll listen to a communist, I'll listen to a libtard, it doesn't matter. I see what people get right and what they get wrong, and I'm able to kind of pull from anybody and everybody. I don't shut down things out of pocket. And so I had a very unconventional group of influences on me. And I would say, to answer your question, my political leanings probably are best associated with the American eugenics movement of the early 20th century, centered around figures like Francis Galton, Charles Davenport and Harry Lotlin, these type, Margaret Sanger. It's eugenics for sure.
And well, explain how that came about, because that's, as you said, it's fairly unusual. So what brought you into that?
Well, if you want to go right back to the base of it, coming up, you know, coming of age, there's, you start getting into women, you start getting into the dating market. And I realized something was very off about it. I realized that females seem to have this absurd amount of bargaining power. And things weren't really lining up. It didn't resemble the dating pools of our parents and our grandparents and things like this. And a couple of bad relationships, and I began to question at a more fundamental level, like sex difference, right? The different components of it. Like, you come to the realization that men and women are not just people with different parts. We have a very different mating strategy altogether. It's borderline zero sum. It's a borderline zero sum game. And I start to think, well, if this is true of sex, it's likely also true of race and all different kind of things, right? So one thing leads to another, and
so different groups compete. Is that what you're saying?
Pardon me, sir?
Different groups compete against each other.
Yes, for sure, yeah. And there's differences in cognitive ability. And again, there's difference in the rate of time preference. Meaning, like, again, your ability to defer gratification is determined by your environment, evolutionarily speaking. The environment that your ancestry is brought up in. And I think that people naturally gravitate to the bottom, meaning men and women alike in all races, they are as immediate to gratify their urges as possible. It's only through situations of scarcity where they begin to have to develop abstract thinking, those who don't die, right? And for certain reasons, females have never necessarily had to consider the long-term survival of the nation state in which they find themselves or whatnot, because of the biological differences. They have inherent value that males don't, if that makes sense, due to their disparate role in reproduction, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's not just chivalry that made men say, you know, women and children first. It was because women are more valuable in terms of reproduction, of continuance of the group.
Yeah. And so continuing down this line of reasoning, I came to the conclusion that, you know, a lot of people want to discuss the problems in the dating markets in psychological terms, like, oh, women have this bad attitude, or men just don't know how to be men, etc. And I was really never satisfied with these type of explanations. They didn't seem to cut it for me. And eventually I keep digging, and I come to understand that there is more males than females. And this has to do with our below replacement level birth rates. It's very multifaceted. And there's very few people talking about this. When people will say, you know, demographics are destiny, right? But they're framing this in an exclusively racial context. I think that demographics as a whole, right? The elderly, the birth dearth, your fertility rate, mortality rate, the male-female ratio, etc. These things come to determine our economic system and our political systems and our behavior more than we like to admit or more than we understand. And so I was not the first to make this realization, but I do think I've developed it at an analytical level a lot further than anybody else has. And this is something that supersedes even racial considerations, because no matter who's in power, doesn't matter if it's the Jays or if it's blacks or whites, it's a population control and elimination of the underclasses is something anybody's going to have to deal with. Anybody is going to be burdened with addressing this.
So this is not, I want to emphasize, just for my own purposes, that this is not saying that this is a pleasant thing or something that we want. It's just you're saying it's a necessity just for practical reasons.
Yeah. Unless you flat out deny scarcity, which is a conversation stopper, right? You're going to have to be faced with this at a certain point. Useless eaters, excess males. We don't, maybe I could get into the reasoning why, because I can already anticipate there's going to be a lot of objections to this.
Yes, probably. I mean, it's a grim topic. And
yes,
people don't like the idea that obviously no one wants to be a useless eater. No one wants to think of themselves in that way. And I honestly doubt that many people listening to this are, because they've already shown a high degree of agency just by being here. But we're talking about the population, the mass population. So you go for it and explain this.
So prior to the 20th century, if I could read some figures here. So at the beginning of the 20th century, we basically overcame infant mortality. And so, prior to the 20th century, 20 to 30 deaths per 100 live births was not uncommon. By the end of the 20th century, that number is around 10 deaths per 1,000 live births. So you've gone from a situation where almost half of children were dying in the first year of life to that number being basically non-existent. Now, males were always overrepresented at birth. There's always more males born than females. The number is usually around 107 to 100. And the reason being is because males have a weaker immune system, I believe, which is why you see females live longer to the end of their lives. And another reason is that, we lived in war and dangerous jobs. So workplace health and safety regulations, and we could say maybe the introduction of atomic weapons creating some degree of like mutually assured destruction may prevent wars wherein enough males are killed in order to maintain this ratio. And this wouldn't be a problem if you had a growing birth rate. You were above 2.1, aka replacement level. These males would be absorbed downward. So there's always more males being born, or there's always more people being born after you. You can mask it. But its population growth is exponential, as we've known for centuries, right, since Malthus and before. It's almost like a pyramid scheme at a certain sense. Like, 4 billion becomes 8, 16, 32, etc. And it gets to a point where you reach the carrying capacity. So once you basically dip below replacement level, these excess males have nowhere to go. And you can see now, it's not usually until about age 35 to 40 where it tapers off 1-to-1. And then from that point on, females start to outnumber males. But we know females' reproductive window is already bygone by that point. So, and another facet of this is that China and India for the better part of three decades were performing sex selective abortions, which targeted females. Each of these nations have, under the age of 35, roughly 50 million more males than females. Most immigration to the West is male. And another facet of this is the freedom of movement and the problems that it causes, wherein you have higher education, females are overrepresented. So they're moving from these rural towns to these cities in a way that they didn't before. Charles Murray's talked about this, the college sorting machines, where in the past, higher education was reserved for very few people. Nowadays, it's basically the norm. And so once upon a time, not too long ago, you had demographics which were fractal, meaning if you were to look at a township, you look at the city, the state, the country, the demographics were pretty stable at all scales. Now you have so much what I call domestic expatriation, that from town to town, it may vary. It's the demographic distortion. It's very hard to get a read on the ratios in any particular place. So this has a lot of explanatory power in historiography, looking at the causes for wars. I'm Scottish like you, and my family came here. We have a scribe that basically says a lot of my ancestry came here because they were excess males left over from a war. It's a very interesting dilemma.
Yeah, there is a well-known thing about this, that when you have too many males, especially young males, milling around in society with not much to do, you've got a problem on your hands, because they have energy, they have testosterone, and they have ambition. They have drive, ego. So there will be trouble. There will be maybe civil unrest, maybe ethnic strife, especially if it's multi-ethnic. And so it's a problem that a government has to have some way to deal with. I don't know how the Chinese handle it. I mean, it's baffling. I guess it was just with the iron fist of authoritarianism that they prevented people going nuts. That's the other thing. When it's not just that they've got nothing to do, it's that they don't have women to couple up with, to pair bond with. So then it's a lonely existence. And that, of course, links with the incel thing now. Do you think there's any direct link there? Is there one of the causes of the incel phenomenon that there simply aren't enough females to go around, or is that?
I think that's solely the cause of it, right? And so no matter what kind of way you try to tell people to just roll up their sleeves, it's not going to cut it. In the United States right now, if you look at the most up-to-date population pyramids, we have 3,150,000 more males than females, just gross, right? Just at a flat gross number under the age of 35. This is for context, right? This is almost the size of what the population of Ireland was in the year 2000. It's, you know, I have a coworker and he said something very interesting to me the other day. I don't broach this subject with him, but he said, you know, he's a spider breeder. He breeds tarantulas, and he was very excited to tell me that he was going to get this certain breed of tarantulas called a Balfour spider. And they are unique in that they're able to live together. However, he said, you have to keep the males and females at a ratio of around 4 to 9. And I said, you know, what happens if you fail to do so? I knew the question already, but he said, well, they fight each other and they badger the females to the point where the females become withdrawn. You get sex segregation, essentially, which I think you see in India, you see in a lot of places. You're seeing happening now in the West, where a lot of these females, they're just dropping out of the game. The men are so needy, and they pull apart, right? The sexes kind of withdraw. I think that, as a friend of mine pointed out, who's been, you know, very influential on some of these ideas, he said, it seems like the value of sex decreases for the side which has the leverage. And leverage would mean whichever side is demographically underrepresented, has, you know, basic Adam Smith supply and demand. They have scarcity, they have leverage.
Yeah, well, there's a whole thing there about young women today just not. In the 90s, it was, I think sex was happening a lot more among young people than it does today. It's a whole thing because of the dating websites. I don't pretend to have a grasp of this. It does interest me very much, but I won't pretend to understand it. It seems that young women have realized that they are the thing they have to offer young men is so valuable to those young men that the young men will do almost anything to get it, or for the hope of getting it.
Yes.
So the young women can really, and I'm not even saying that this is a widespread phenomenon, but although I do hear about it a lot, that the young women can basically lead young men on because they know they're so horny. They're so desperate for sex. So sex has become this thing that isn't worth much to the women, and yet they don't give it out because it's worth so much to the men.
Yes, of course. And even the idea of the possibility of it is enough to get a lot of men to bend the knee. And this is what, like, as Kurt Doolittle called baiting into hazard with false promise, right? They can basically lead these people off a cliff and then capitalize on the proceeds of having done so. And it has implications toward all of politics, I think, in general. And the other thing too is how do we address this, right? Like, how do we, it's going to re-envision the way that we value people as a whole.
Yeah, go into that. I mean, I think we have emerged from an age in which it was assumed that everyone has value and everyone is equally valuable, which is obviously not true, but it does result in a certain level of civility and in society. We've got this idea that everyone matters. Are you saying that that's an illusion that's just going to have to fall away?
I think that as you sort of emerge out of the state of nature, right, this more tumultuous, imperialistic, like, violence and instability, and you start to stabilize things under rule of law and things like this, right? The states taking control of law enforcement and things like this, the male role becomes increasingly diminished. And I've gotten myself in, you know, a degree of hot water. I've gotten some haters for saying this. I think the traditional male role has kind of become superfluous. A lot of what they've been able to provide is being outsourced to the state, right? Females, they have more earning potentials now. They're going to school more. You have guns, you have dogs, home security systems, the police, the male. And I think that, again, we almost are tending towards something eusocial, more like termites, more like ants or spiders, where the male role is not dispensable, but it becomes diminishable to such a subsidiary role. And I see this trend emerging. I think if we were to kind of bring back male importance to the fore, it would mean that we had fallen out of a stable state in a certain sense, if that makes sense.
Could you explain that? Because I'm not sure I'm following.
So the male role is, it finds its importance in protection, provision, things of this nature, right? We need men to protect women from other men, to protect families, fatherhood, etc. But as we begin to come out of that state of nature, right, and we start to settle in something more stable, like an ant colony, right? They've kind of overcome their whatever problems they have. They have a formula that they repeat, and it becomes very stabilized. And you see the male role become diminished and diminished until they end up something as like drones. And I think I, you know, see certain trends like this with where we're going politically, just the complete male disposability going into near infinity. A lot of people will argue, you know, for male value under the auspice of like geniuses or these great men or whatever. But I don't think it's disingenuous to conflate, you know, these genius men who built civilizations, people like Isaac Newton, Charles Darwin. I think that it's kind of disingenuous to conflate these with the average male who has lost his place to a large degree.
Yeah, I see this with the working class because of machinery, automation, but also increasingly the middle class as well because of AI, where they've lost their place. The society just doesn't have a need for them. So I think the question is, well, society doesn't have a need for them because of increased efficiency. We have sought efficiency really at any cost. So the question is, can we envisage a society which does not prize efficiency above all, and therefore in which there is a place for the middle class and the working class? Or would that be dysgenic?
Well, I think in order to facilitate that, it's going to require kind of a move beyond humanism. Humanism of any sort, whether it's Christian humanism, liberal humanism, this idea that humans are the star of this movie rather than one part in an environment which requires some ability to sustain itself across time into perpetuity, right? And I think that, again, I think eugenics is the end of history. I think it's the end of science. I think that no matter if you agree with me or not, you're going to have to face it. In the early 20th century, this was just commonplace. It was just accepted as self-evident and obvious. Like if I could read a list of people here who were fundamental in this.
The eugenics thing was amazing in the early 20th century. It's incredible what people were saying in those days. And like prior to World War II, maybe even during World War II, but I don't know, but it's certainly after World War II, it seems to have just vanished completely from the West. I'm
they lost the war. They didn't lose the argument, though.
Oh yeah, I know. I'm just noting that the West seemed to completely turn its back on this. I don't really know why that happened exactly, but I'm it's an interesting question.
Certain groups of people profit off of proliferating bad genes. They can leverage against the moral middle class, right?
Yeah, because prior to this, the idea of eugenics was popular on both the right and the left, and I think even especially on the left, and which is kind of bizarre.
It transcends politics, really. It, regardless of what your political leaning is, right? These people were liberals. They were not what we conceive today as liberal by any stretch, but the Darwinists, right? People like Alexander Graham Bell, people like John Maynard Keynes, Henry Ford, and H.G. Wells, et cetera, like just a who's who, Nikola Tesla, Francis Crick, the smartest men who'd ever lived. And 100 years later, if that, we're expected to believe that they just somehow were all misguided on this point. Like, you know, yeah, we take their other work very seriously, but on this one point, they just seem to have completely been disillusioned to believe that. And so it makes sense to me why it would transcend this left-right dichotomy. It's regardless what you value. We've known since Francis Galton published, right, human inquiries into their faculties. People with bad genes have more fecundity. They breed at a much faster rate. Any animal is like this. Like, look at the rate of reproduction between fish and whales, for example, right? Or frogs, rather. There's a trade-off between quality and quantity of offspring, and we've known this. If you don't check the breeding of these lower classes, then they skew your distribution. They pull down the mean with them. And because they can't evolve, they basically say, I had this analogy where they create a standoff situation. You're trying to climb up the ladder, and they basically stand there and say, either you carry me on your back, or as soon as you try to ascend up that ladder, I'm kicking it out from under you, and nobody's going to get up. And so you say, all right, I'll carry you on my back. And then the next guy comes along. Me too. Me too. You get to a point where you can't anymore. And I'll give you one example. I was going into work just the other week. I work in a pretty bad area of the city, and I've seen a mother walking her daughter to school. Now, this mother was a midget. She was clearly had dwarfism, and she was a white woman, and the daughter walking with her was mixed race, you could tell, and she had physiognomic signs of dwarfism herself. So a black guy had gotten this midget woman pregnant and unfortunately passed it to the daughter. She's now going into the public school building, and I'm going into my job to pay for it. I'm not trying to be cruel here, but it's animalism to me. The idea that anybody can find somebody with a fertile womb and that's enough, right? You can't go fishing without a license. You can't hunt, you can't drive. But when it comes to reproduction, the most important form of a nation's capital, the human capital, it's just anarchic, pure anarchy. It's animalism. I can't stress that enough.
Yeah, I understand the point you're making. I guess that for that woman, the black guy was the best that she could get. Or that she felt that was the case, and that's why she reproduced with him. What you're saying is that, well, what you're alluding to is that there should be some sort of licensing, some sort of control for how. And you know, I've listened to a guy who was involved in legalities, and he was crying. I've never heard him crying about anything else, and he was crying because a retarded, like literally, so mentally subnormal woman had been impregnated by multiple guys because she didn't have the wherewithal to say no, and she'd been abused, basically just used.
Yeah.
And as a result, she'd had numerous kids, and now of course the state had to look after the kids financially, and but also not just financially, but also to send in care workers because she literally wasn't bright enough to look after the kids. So, and this guy who was handling the legalities around this case was crying because he was saying, what to do about someone like this? I mean, it's an absolute tragedy. It's a tragedy that she can have kids like this because it's just creating a terrible situation that she has to live through. But the alternative is to forcibly sterilize her. And that also is a tragedy. I mean, there's just nothing good about it. There's no light to this. It's awful.
I remember an ex-girlfriend of mine. She worked with people in a home that had extreme disabilities whose families couldn't care for them. And one gentleman who was a resident there, he had no arms or legs, and his head was shaped like a cone. And all he did was sit in a chair and rock back and forth all day. People don't like to talk about this stuff. But it gets to a point where, you know, I've had to question, like, what are we doing as a society? First of all, it's debatable if you're doing the individual disservice by not doing this, let alone all of the costs that are going to be externalized onto the whole of society. I started to think of it like in terms of a lifeboat, right? Like the famous quote by Pentti Linkola where he says, you know, a boat capsizes and everybody piles into the lifeboat. And there's two kind of people. There's the people that hate life, that continue to pull people out of the water, knowing that there's a finite capacity for this ship to carry them. And he said, the people who love life will grab the ship's axe and sever the hands clinging to the side. People don't want to believe that we have to make decisions like this by necessity. We don't have the luxury to sit it out. And a lot of these wignats, they want to say, well, we just send the blacks over here and we send the Chinese over there and everybody stays in their own little playpen. And there you go, problem solved. That doesn't cut it. It goes beyond race, right? We have these, you know, dysgenic whites and they've been allowed to breed for too long. They've bankrupted the genetic stock of our race through laissez-faire reproduction, period.
Yeah, I obviously this is very dangerous territory for even to discuss, because the ways out of it, I mean, our society 100 years ago could contemplate and discuss the ways out of it easily. but nowadays, I could get accused of all sorts of things.
Sure, and I'm not trying to
emphasize, I'm not advocating anything.
Yeah.
What we're doing is discussing, in as honest a way as possible, a reality that is very challenging. It is very unpleasant, and I don't think any of us like it. But it is a reality, and sooner or later, someone is going to have to deal with it. Some society is going to have to, whether it's ours or our successor of it, is going to have to come up with something that is done with to, alleviate these situations.
What I say to this is, let this be a lesson to people of the future who may listen to this. The longer you neglect, the harder these decisions get. The longer it's allowed to go on in this anarchistic, no oversight kind of way, the harder these decisions get, the more grim it becomes.
Yeah. You see, I mean, it's not all or nothing, though. I mean, there are ways. You know, you could have a home for someone like that woman I just described. There could be a place that she is looked after and not allowed to fraternize with men. Nunnery, a convent. This is, I guess, one of the uses for convents back in the day. And perhaps even still now, although no one will say it openly. But I think there are more humane ways. I mean, I don't think that it needs to be brutal. But I think a government does need to look at these matters in a very hard-headed way. Because otherwise it is going to spill over. And another thing that I can say from my own anecdotal experience is, I knew a woman a long time ago, 10, 15 years ago now, who had never had a job in her life. She was addicted to pot smoking and she was basically just trash. Completely ignorant, not bright, loud, aggressive, just awful person. And she'd had 6 kids by, I think, 4 different men.
Yeah.
And
hyper fertile.
Yeah, yeah. And then you think about some, like a couple of lawyers, a nice married middle class couple, and they've got 1 kid. I mean, what the fuck? It just is a reality. What is that's in one generation? She's multiplying herself by 6. They're having their number, the lawyer couple. And that's not that I've got any particular fondness for lawyers, by the way. Just using that as a stereotypical example.
Sure.
Because it's true. I mean, we all know it's true. The upper middle class, certainly the middle class, are not having as many kids as they used to. And this is just clearly visible.
And the solution isn't to encourage them necessarily, in my mind, to have more. It's a preventative measure, not an inductive one. You prevent those that are unfit. This is the spirit of negative eugenics, is placing limitations on those that are unfit, but you're not trying to induce a certain type of outcome. You give as much room for human freedom in this process as possible, but there are limits there. And so we've always known, or at least for centuries, we've known that those who have fewer offspring, right? The reason people begin to tend toward this K strategy, meaning fewer offspring and a greater degree of parental investment, is due to scarcity. This is the paradox of plenty, right? Which kind of perplexed economists and anthropologists for a long time. Why do these environments that are so resource abundant, the peoples inhabiting them seem to exhibit such a slow, if negligible, rate of evolution, whereas people that live in these very rough climates that are inconducive to prosperity, they tend to advance very quickly. And you cannot have as many children when you're living closer to the carrying capacity of an environment. As such, there's a greater degree of investment necessary to protect your child, educate them, and see them through to adulthood. This basically retards their rate of evolution, or rate of maturation, rather, to where their brain is, it develops later and for longer. It's gestating longer. And they begin to retain more juvenile features into adulthood. This is known as neoteny. And this is where you get people's, like Japanese people, right? Really big heads, child-looking, very smart. High IQs, they solve problems with words instead of fists. And then you get other groups, which I won't name. We all know who they are. They learn to walk sooner. They learn to talk sooner. They enter puberty earlier. They have a fast life history strategy. It's just breed, breed, breed. No investment. Play the numbers game. The environment is abundant enough to just, they'll find some bananas to eat and that's basically it. It's only scarcity. Scarcity is the only vector of domestication. Domesticating man out of barbarism, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it comes back to a question that I actually asked you before, which is, what do you think society is for? And this is a question that each of us will have a different answer to. Because you could, as I said earlier, you could say that if society is about efficiency, then clearly you wouldn't want these people reproducing. If that's your priority, then yeah, you would want to implement policies of whatever nature to discourage them from breeding,
sure,
from reproducing, and you'd want to encourage the upper class, the upper middle class, to have loads of kids. As it happens, I do like the idea of it, high IQ people, capable people, imaginative people, having lots of children, even though they do tend to be the worst of champagne socialists, Guardian readers and so on. Leaving that aside, I like the idea of capability and intelligence increasing in society, and talent increasing in society. But that does appeal to me. Just the idea of society getting better. And I think that's one thing. But the question of efficiency at all costs is obviously where people are going to part ways with you, with what you're alluding to here, which is deeply eugenic, to the point of you would need a serious authoritarian government to implement the kinds of measures you're talking about. But to get back to the question, what is society for? Is it for efficiency and maximizing this or that? Or is it for enabling people to live good lives? Or something else? I mean, what do you envisage society being in the broadest sense?
So you asked me this question in the one other conversation we had, and it stumped me, I'll be honest, because I'm used to answering, you put it very forthright, and I was used to answering something a lot more specific to something and to just throw a question like so fundamental like that. But I thought about it. The idea, and again, the spirit of negative eugenics is to simply remove inhibitions to the creative process of man, right? I think what I value innovation. I value letting ideas emerge, proliferate, art, cultures, things like this. And in order to allow them to flourish, you have to prevent those who parasite because they cannot compete. People who rent seek, people who stand out in the middle of the road and block traffic and say, nobody gets to progress unless you carry me with you because I'm evolutionarily unfit. I don't have I don't have the ability to compete, even if I wanted to. A lot of people don't. Even if they were the most well-meaning people in the world, the barrier to entry for meaningful participation in a 21st century society, the bar is raised pretty high. You know, even a lot of us might not be cutting it in the next few decades. Like, you have to be tech savvy. You have to be literate about a lot of these things, which I'm not. I think you need to move these people, but I don't like to force outcomes. I don't like to induce a certain predetermined outcome. I think that, and this is another take that people, listeners of this may not like, I'm not particularly keen of Nazi eugenics, because I think it's overly inductive. I think it's unscientific to a large extent and overly romantic. I think it's overly prioritizing aesthetic outcomes. I want there to be a market for genuine innovation, but in order to have that, we need to remove those who stand in the way of it. And so I value that. And because I value that, you have to make hard decisions.
So, okay. I'm not really sure what to say to that. Do you see yourself as any kind of romantic?
I have ideals, certainly. Yeah, for sure. But I think that to romanticize man in this way, that regardless of his merits and his qualifications, that somehow his life has value. I think that it may be counterintuitive to the way that we're brought up and raised in the West, but I think that this is inhumane to say, you know, despite my inability to contribute to society, I'm just a man, right? If you appeal to some kind of higher being, you know, God makes no mistakes. I'm God's child. I'm a child of God, just as you are. Just because, you know, I'm dumb and you're smart, you know, I don't need to qualify my existence in this way. I think that that is very inhumane in a certain sense, if that.
So the idea that people shouldn't have to, people's existence shouldn't have to be justified. Well, I don't know. Again, it comes back to what you think society is for. But one other thing that someone said in the chat is that this doesn't actually work in practice, because if you, if you want innovation, then you have to allow people freedom. And that allows for the combinations of genes that you wouldn't plan for.
Again, I think that criticism, it's a more geared toward a positive eugenics program. It's like I'm trying to explain this idea of a via negativa, right? A negative. Like, it's not so much about how many smart people you have or how many beautiful people. It's how many dumb people you don't have, right? The rest, you're maximizing the window for emergent order, for novelty to emerge out of this marketplace, right? Whoever, anyone is fit to breed as long as they're not unfit to breed. Something like this, right? You're trying to maximize that window precisely to facilitate emergent order. You're not trying to say, okay, Joe, you need to go and have a baby with Jill because we like that you guys are both tall and we want tall people. That's not at all what I'm proposing here. I would be vehemently against a type of prescription like that. So,
right. Some people are suggesting that you should speak to JF about this matter, about evolution, because you're presuming that it has direction. But what is good today is not always good for tomorrow. I don't know.
Sure.
I could try to put you in touch with JF if you'd be interested in that.
Yeah, for sure. I'm a pragmatist. Yeah. I'm a pragmatist across the board, right? Like, if you were to ask me, well, what's the best political system? I'll ask you, well, what's the situation? What's the situation on the ground, right? Maybe National Socialism is better now. Maybe communism is better now. I'm a situationalist, a pragmatist. I don't think these ideas have any value for themselves. They're instruments, they're tools. And I would disagree with Keith Woods in his saying that a lot of the philanthropists we currently have are just ideologues. Like, they truly believe in the moral and ethical tenets of neoliberalism. I don't believe that. I believe that in another situation, a lot of these guys would be throwing pitchforks and, you know, hanging blacks or whatever. I don't think that they're married to these. I don't think they're married to the ideas they profess. They're Machiavellian. They are pragmatic in their adoption and their implementation of these ideas.
I agree, but I also think that they do have a vision for society in the end. I mean, I do. You know, some people have said that the people in charge of our society today don't have a vision for the future. I think they do. It's just that it's a vision in which 95% of people are irrelevant. And that's the problem.
Sure.
And that includes Klaus Schwab, you know, to whatever extent he does have his own ideas. It doesn't really matter. I think he does represent, he embodies certain ideas. And they're not pleasant. As I've said before, I'm millennial. I think it's, you know, people like us would be completely irrelevant. I don't know whether we would be literally in a pod eating bugs, but we would have no agency, no influence in society at all, and possibly no jobs, no employment. It would be what Harari wants, or advocated for us, which is drugs and video games. That's a meaningless existence for most people. So I wouldn't want that.
To the question of direction, basically, and I talk about teleology a lot on my channel, right? The directedness of history, the directedness, the human trajectory of evolutionary trajectory, right? You could take a lot of different views on this. You can have an open or a closed-ended. You could talk like Ray Kurzweil and these guys. They believe we're headed for this singularity, right? Wherein, you know, Hegel was like this as well, the end of history, where no matter where you begin from, no matter which point, you always circle the drain and end in the same place. And it's you end in the end of history. Then you have other views which are open-ended. You could talk about like a process philosophy, Alfred North Whitehead, where they believe that the process itself is kind of the whole purpose of life and evolution and politic is just to facilitate new forms of novelty for us to appreciate. And as he said, you know, the many become one and are increased by one. It's, I would probably tend more toward the latter. But again, you have to have some kind of an ideal. You can't blindly wander. So there are people that, I believe all idealizations of the future are arbitrary, but that doesn't make them useless. That they may be necessary, arbitrary though they may be. Did that make sense?
Yes, of course, because we're operating from a subjective perspective. You know, we're not. Yeah. We're not God. We're not some huge Uber AI. We are where we are, and we're thinking about what we ultimately want, what appeals to us.
Sure.
Which is ultimately an emotional appraisal.
Yeah.
Of various options. So yeah, I agree with you on that matter. I think that a mistake that a lot of people make is to assume that they are objective and logical when they're really not. Because if someone thinks that about themselves, then emotion takes them unawares. You know, it controls without them being aware of it. It's a very dangerous. A long time ago, before my channel, I've wasted a lot of time on Facebook, on the INTP group, personality group page, just arguing with people who were convinced that they were so rational and logical. And it was interesting, but it was punishing. Because
I could imagine.
Oh, an ordeal. It was such an ordeal that I was going to document it on my channel, but I could only manage two videos.
That would have been.
I think I had about 10 planned, and I just couldn't do it because it was so nightmarish. because they're so, it's not just autism, it's logic for its own sake. And I remember one guy actually said, openly, he said that I prefer an elegant, what was it? An elegant analysis to a messy reality. So the actual reality on the ground doesn't matter to him so much as an elegant summary of it. So an elegant algorithm, you know. And I thought, well, I mean, that was when I realized I'm just out of place. And when I eventually did a personality test again and it wasn't INTP, I was relieved. But it also clarified for me that I really should never have been in that group in the first place.
Yeah.
But that was sounds older. I think when I was younger, I was INTP. And then after the age of 25, it sort of changed.
I've come to see all of psychology, and this is kind of off discussion, but I've come to see it all as basically woo-woo nonsense. And I'd like to see the language of psychology completely eliminated from the discourse. I think that it's founded on folk theories of the mind that are outdated. And I think at this point it exists merely as a weapon by people who I shall not name on here to basically just beat you over the head with. It's a female method of war, more or less. And I think that we should look for more rigorous and analytical explanations.
Maybe you're just insecure.
I think it's got to go for sure. It's literally just a way to circumvent a point that somebody's made. You know, oh, you sound beta, or you sound this or that. It's not an argument, bro. You gotta formalize something. So I'd like to see. I'd like to see the whole language and idea around that just be completely removed, but that may be optimistic for the meanwhile.
So, I mean, you presumably don't think that you would have anything to hide there, that you see yourself as quite pragmatic yourself. I mean, not
sure
by emotion.
Again, I believe, you know, my form of pragmatism takes the form of instrumentalism. I think that these things are instruments. They're to be judged. Ideas are to be judged in their ability to solve problems, not for some kind of elegance, as you said in your story there, some kind of like internal coherence that they possess. But how can I apply the ideas of, you know, whatever, communism, liberalism, national socialism, monarchism, how can I apply it to solve these problems? And that's what it's worth. And I apply the same thing to humans too, especially, unfortunately, males are a performative sex. We don't have our value baked into us. We have to go and demonstrate some pragmatic value, applicable value. And I'm not averse to doing that. I'm not averse to testing myself against a eugenics program. You know, if you want to do a fitness test or you want to do a math test or whatever, I'm up for it. I'm not going to shy away. And I'm also willing to accept that, you know, in bargaining for my own value, I can't just appeal to sentimentalism. Well, my mom really loves me, so therefore I'm valuable. Or you know, Jeebus said that I'm perfectly happy to go and try to argue for it absent all of these kind of romantic appeals. One way somebody may do that is they could say, I've given this example. Okay, so I'm a personal trainer. I'm a very good personal trainer, above average. I have helped X amount of people to lose weight. Okay, here's my testimonials, here's my proof. By having done this, we can now quantify how much money was saved on the healthcare system, for example. So if you keep me around, right, this is my contribution to society. And by helping these people lose weight, I've now offset the cost of my own existence, which would be things like, you know, every time you flush the toilet, that costs money. We have to treat the water, right? Every time you eat a piece of beef, that costs money. Okay, how can you, like, do you offset your cost benefit? And people will say, oh, this is dehumanizing. I think it's dehumanizing to decouple human value from its qualification, then what exactly do you value about a person? Like, if it's not their merit, do you know what I mean? If it's not their demonstrated abilities, then what is it that you value in them?
I don't know. I think there are all sorts of things. I mean, it's not just abilities. I think there are the way a person reacts to something. I might find endearing. I might find admirable. I might find life-affirming. I might find warm. The way someone deals with struggle or hardship. The way someone helps another person who's in need. And when they themselves are in need. These things seem, if not valuable to me, then certainly admirable.
Sure. I wish that when I had been younger, somebody would have told me, you know, if I'd have been 10 or 12 years old, I wish somebody whispered in my ear and said, when you grow up, you're not guaranteed a meaningful role in society. You know, there's 300 people that want to get on the bus and there's only 50 seats, right? And so you better consider that, because I think a lot of people are raised in the West to believe that they're a puzzle piece and they fit in somewhere and everybody has a place to stand and you'll find yours.
You said in one of your videos that you came from quite a nice middle-class background, as I did. Yeah. And I think it's a bad start in life in some ways, because certainly I grew up looking forward to you know, trying, working hard, giving of myself and all that. But I also grew up with an assumption that life wouldn't be difficult somehow. Yeah. So I don't know how that idea got in there, but it did.
Yeah.
And it really massively tripped me up in my early 20s, leading to I just completely screwed my 20s, and that has had serious long term effects that I'm still dealing with now. Really, in many ways, I'm 10 years behind where I should be, and I think that's how important it is. And this is why I can completely agree with you. I wish someone had really impressed upon me.
Yeah,
life is going to be fucking difficult.
Yeah,
it's not just that you'll have to try hard and work hard, it's that when you get, it's that you will get knocked down anyway. And when that happens, then you have to get back up. You have to get back up. I wish someone had told me that and like really impressed it upon me. But I think they probably did, and I just wasn't listening because I was so fucking full of myself.
Well, this segues into my next point that I want to make. And this is kind of how I lost my first channel, unfortunately. But there are certain people, and I've talked to them, and they are just not cut out for it. They're not competitive. And again, as a personal trainer, you'll realize right away, if somebody has drive, you can give them all the information and sky's the limit, but you can't instill competition in them in the first place. It's impossible, right? It's like leading a horse to water and trying to make him drink. Some people just want off the ride. They really do. They're not fit for it. And I did become a proponent of some of these MAID bills that are coming out in Canada under, you know, the Trudeau government. And it is a very hyperbolic policy, but I think we live in a very hyperbolic climate, right? And for listeners who are maybe not aware, this was the idea that medical assistance in dying would be provided not only to terminally ill patients with physiological ailments, but to people that are mentally ill, right? They're chronically mentally ill. And I think that at this point, it's just a necessary relief valve. A lot of people that probably would have been checked by infant mortality in the past, all the Darwinian filters have been removed. These people were born for no reason because their parents were in a heat of passion or they liked the idea of having a child. And the parents too assumed when the child came of age, they fall into place like a little puzzle piece. And now they're living this like meager existence, and they want off the ride. They don't want to compete. They don't want to go and pass the bar. They don't want to read a bunch of books or lift a bunch of weights. They just want, they want out of it, right? And I think at that point, you might as well let them.
I mean, I have known a few people like this. One, not many, but a few, who you can help them and help them and help them and help them. And they'll even respond in ways that give you hope, that make you think that, okay, he's going to try now, he's going to do it. But they're just telling you what you want to hear. And really, they just don't have fight in them. I mean, the word compete is perhaps misleading here. I would put it more broadly as just this effort to fight back. And this can be because they're comfortable in their depression, which I was for a long time. So I might project that onto other people. Or it can be that they just don't have the confidence. They just don't have an innate belief in themselves. And I think that there are certain childhoods that can do that to a person. If your childhood, I mean, this is how life is so hazardous, because it can go either way. If your childhood is all about other people, then you don't develop a sense of yourself, and then you can develop into an adult who just doesn't have much fight.
Yeah,
because it's all you know is how to serve other people. But conversely, if your childhood is all about you, then you're a spoiled, narcissistic piece of
shit. Set up to fail. Yep.
Yes. You think that it's going to be too easy, and you think that other people are just there for you. Obviously there needs to be a middle ground. But the point I'm making is that I have known people like this, and I have thought, okay. For example, you keep getting abused by women over and over and over again. You see the red flags after it's happened to you once, twice, three times. You see the red flags and you go for it a fourth time. You let it happen. You invite it.
Yeah.
And you know, it's one thing to have this happen to you once or twice, even, but four or five times. I think there are guys like this. That's one example. There are other things that was a similar thing where the guy basically knows failure, and that's all he knows. He knows defeat. He knows humiliation. He knows to be exploited, or he knows despondency. He knows demoralization. He knows pessimism. He knows defeatism. He knows defeat. He knows it very well. He knows it over and over again, and so he can't really conceive. I mean, even if he can conceive of success, he can't honestly conceive of himself having success. So he's paralyzed. And then when other people try to pep him up, he'll politely go along with it, but he's only being polite. Really, fundamentally, he sees himself as a fuck up.
Yeah.
And I don't know, beyond a certain age, I don't know if there is anything you can do. You lead the horse to water. I don't know if you can legitimately hope for more.
Even if you could reform these people, the amount of investment could never really be justified, because it could have gone to somebody else, right? Again, finitude. I've helped a lot of people in a lot of different ways, and not trying to toot my own horn. If somebody gives you an inch, I'll give them 500 miles. But if people won't give that first little bit, I mean, for me, I almost start to get frustrated at them. And I understand to an extent that's a fault of my own, because they are better viewed as bots rather than somebody who's, you know, large and in charge of their destiny. But for me, I'm perfectly fine with, you know, allowing them to just get in the suey pod and take themselves out of the, I'm not, it's, yeah.
I mean, look, I'm not going to agree with that, but I can understand why you feel that way.
Fair enough.
But I mean, someone did just point out in the chat, yeah, I was on welfare for 10 years, so easily I could have fallen by the wayside. That is true. Therefore I'm not making any absolute statements here. Someone could be on welfare for 10 years and then find themselves useful to other people. It can. Demonstrably, it can happen. You know, this is why I'm not really against UBI or what the welfare state, because I think in this day and age, a lot of people, you know, there isn't a place for them, certainly not immediately. So I think society should be flexible in that way. But then there is the type who just doesn't want, basically they don't know how to get better. They don't see themselves as capable of that. And that is a problem. I don't know what should be done. I think a long time ago, 100 years ago, society would just have, we didn't have as much, provision to look after people. A lot of people would just have fallen by the wayside. Some guy would have just drunk himself to death or killed himself, where now he's on antidepressants. Yeah. And I don't like it, but there we go.
I understand that there are these exceptions to the rule. One thing that's leveled against, right, the father of eugenics, Francis Galton, right, arguably the smartest man who ever lived. He was a very flawed person. He had mental illnesses, which caused him to withdraw from society at certain points in his life. And I understand that. But I think, again, that we've left the problem too long, which increases the demand for authority to intervene. This is why you want to stay on top of things, right, in the future. I view this as like a demographic chemotherapy, depopulation, which I am in support of. I view it as almost like chemotherapy. You're going to get a lot of collateral damage in this process, but the cost of not doing so at this point is damn near extinction. They'll at the very least reduce us to animalism. They'll reduce us down to the state of nature, if not extinction. And I think that the situation on the ground has become so desperate that so too the measures are going to have to be to kind of correct course and counteract it. But that's more or less where I stand with it. There's so much to talk about that this conversation here, it hasn't even scratched the surface. I've made 200 videos in 7 months or 8 months, 20 minutes each. I don't even think I've begun to talk about the pertinent issue. Like, it's such a vast subject matter that I find, you know, just kind of taking one little facet of the issue and making this piecemeal, you know, focusing on one particular at a time and building the argument has been the only way I've been able to manage it. But that's the crux of it anyways.
Okay. What would you say about, you said in your notes about post-humanism. I think most people have an understanding of humanism in their heads, but what do you mean by post-humanism?
I think that humanism takes multiple forms, right? We have theistic humanism, we have secular humanism, but maybe one of the core commitments of a humanistic ideology would be that the human animal, human man, is fundamentally different in type than other animals are different. Like, you could look at vitalism, right? The idea of vitalism, like, somehow we are wholly differentiated from the rest of nature, from the rest of the animal kingdom. This idea is built right into the very basis of, for example, like Abrahamic religions, that, you know, everything was here to service Adam and even Eve herself. And it's like humans are the main character. They have this protagonist complex. I look at humans as, obviously, we have the greatest degree of cognitive faculty, bar none. There's no competition in the animal kingdom for our cognitive faculties. However, I think that we are just another piece of a greater picture, if that makes sense. We are not to view ourselves with this type of absolute primacy over nature, if that makes sense. So it's just the move to a more holistic reframing of human beings. I think that like a lot of anthropologists did just a few centuries ago, I think that a lot of people that we call humans, I think they're animals. I think that there is no difference. And I'm not going to, you know, say anything too compromising here, but I think that they're animals. They're not discernible from beasts of the field, beasts of the earth. They're undomesticated. They're feral. Very few people. It's very anomalous in nature to domesticate man, to see this kind of beauty and knowledge culminating in like a great man like Isaac Newton or something. That's weird. That's not default. That's the default state of man is tooth and claw and barbarism, and it. I don't think that we differ, and I think that we need to kind of deflate our special ego, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I do agree with you there that man is ultimately an animal. Human beings are ultimately
sure.
That it's true, and you see it in a lot of their decisions, in a lot of their behavior. So I agree, and I think that civilization is a fairly thin veneer. Law and the fear of punishment, the fear of pain, is, and I think in ideally the fear of God, is necessary in order to make people behave themselves. I think this is true. A lot
carrots
of people
and stick.
Don't care about being good for its own sake.
Yeah, and a lot of people, their rate of time preference is so high that they can't extrapolate beyond the present moment in order to see, like, certain things that are beneficial in the moment are entirely detrimental next week, next month, next year, next 10 years, right? So you have this tension between you want to eat this piece of cake in front of you right now, but you want to not be fat, right? Which is requires some ability to abstract into the consequences resulting from your decisions in the moment. If you don't have that, you're a fucking animal, dude. There's no difference. Like, certain kids, certain guys now, they can't go, you know, a couple hours without masturbating to porn. Like, it's gotten that bad. And I go to Walmart. I went to Walmart earlier, and there's, you know, horrendously obese people walking around here. Now, some people might like to argue, they'd say, well, the government made them like this, right? The government put out all of this high fructose corn syrup, all this shit. Well, not everybody's fat, right? It's like there's two ways to address this. Do you take away a person's ability to harm themselves? I see people that will have four cans of Pepsi with their dinner, right? And we all have universal health care. They take more than what they put into the healthcare system by their selfish behaviors. Do we allow this, or do we actually outlaw Pepsi, right? Do you want the libertarian approach, or do you want the fascist approach? I think if it does come to the point where we had to take away somebody's ability to destroy themselves because they can't live in a society with sugar without placing their own limits, then they're fucking slaves. You reduce them to the very bottom of a caste system. You're a slave. Okay, we saved you from yourself, but you're not a free man anymore. You haven't demonstrated any ability to control yourself. So impulsivity, it goes into infinity at a certain point.
I think conscientiousness is a huge thing. It's something that I lack. And I wish I didn't, because I see the combination of, well, just that in itself, but also the combination of it with intelligence means that, I mean, you've got a pretty formidable human being. You know, it's a combination that, you could say that it does raise us above the animals. But it's the force that takes us farther away from the animals, let's put it that way. So some people are saying in the comments that you're an ANCAP, but I don't think you are really an anarcho-capitalist, are you?
No, I do. Again, the spirit of negative eugenics is to facilitate a type of market for random emergence of orders. So in a certain sense, yeah, I don't want to stifle people's innovation by, you know, closing down the market, which having an open market for competition, it facilitates the quickest rate of trial and error. We know this, right? So it can rapidly accelerate the rate of innovation. However, I'm not an anarchist, right? So to say that I'm an ANCAP, I believe a big state is required for free markets. I believe you need a big authoritarian state to come in and say, hey, you didn't qualify for reproduction. Sorry. If you reproduce against the law, then you're delinquent. I don't believe in anarchy. I believe in the furthest thing from it. I believe in a big state which protects the market from rent seeking, predation, parasitism, things like this.
I agree. And that's why I didn't think you were an ANCAP, because you talk a lot about control, limiting of degeneration. I agree with you. Do you have anything to say? Because I did say with iHypocrite that there seems to be a thing with Canada and libertarianism. Is that something that I've just imagined?
Canada is an interesting political climate. It's almost like France, to where if you're not from here, if you're outside, it's very hard to understand it. That we don't have these kind of nationalist sentiments in the same way that somebody in, say, Ireland may. Like Justin already declared us, he said, we're the first post-national state. Again, me personally, there are maybe certain libertarian threats, not anarchic ones for sure, but I'm a utilitarian. I'm not a moralist. I believe ultimately might is right. If we can't come to some type of agreement about our moral dispositions and values, then the only way to rectify the dispute is, again, might. This is how it's been. I don't think it's very multifaceted. And again, you'd have to sort of follow my content to get a better handle on what my ideological commitments are. But they're not ANCAP.
Right, okay. That's okay then.
I've been called a commie. I've been called a libshit. I've been called it all. So I think I don't fit well into a box. I'm kind of beyond politics at this point. I don't concern myself overly with state politics. It's more of a meta analysis of you know, selection criterion and things of that nature.
All right. People are asking, is there anything that your worldview and of what you've said here, at least in this, and you know, we're only talking about this conversation.
Sure.
A lot of what you said is quite negative. For example, someone said that, yeah, that midget woman, that's it's a negligible percentage of the population. So it doesn't actually matter. But another, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that. But another thing is also that this is stuff that we could work out if we had our own society. Right now, we have the threat of demographics, which really just ruins everything.
Sure.
We can't design a society where anything works because, there is an elite who have their own plans. That's true. But I think in people's minds, the concern is we are being replaced. And if we had our own society, an ethnostate or something of that nature, something akin to that, then it really wouldn't matter that a lot of people were less intelligent, less capable, and so on, because we would simply have a social system that enabled them to survive, and we would have social mores that curtailed their behavior.
Sure.
So, I mean, what would you say about that?
So I'm going to address this as best I can. It's a little bit nuanced. There's a very common misunderstanding, I think, that's made pertaining to the relation between race and genetics and how they interact. I think a lot of, dogmatically racial nativist in these spheres, they put the cart before the horse in a certain way. These phenotypic traits that white peoples possess, right? Red hair, blue eyes, etc. They correspond to good genetics, typically, right? There's variation, however, within every sample. When you start to input that as a criteria itself, you can unintentionally get like a runaway selection, like a Fisherian runaway, where, again, going back to pragmatism, you start believing that these traits have value for their own sake rather than in their application or what they correspond to. Like somebody who has an 85 IQ, they're on the sex offenders list and they're in and out of prison, but they're white, they're blonde, right? They have no value, period. So you have to be careful using that. I think that race follows from genes and not the inverse. It's race is the output of what you get from good breeding and limiting genetic load. I don't think that it serves very well as an input, because say you did get an all white nation, but the average IQ was 80 and criminality was through the roof. I don't think that would have any value. I just don't see it, right? And that very well is at least theoretically possible. So,
well, an all white nation where the IQ was through the roof.
Sure, but we got our IQ high through capital punishment. Like we were hanging 2% people. We didn't say we like people because they're white, right? I'll give you an example that I've often used is Cesar Chavez. So for anybody who's not familiar with Cesar Chavez, he was a union organizer and a Mexican national in I think he's in California or Midwest area or something. Him and his union guys would routinely go down to the borders and they would beat the fuck out of other Mexicans that were coming through the borders because, again, right, if you paradoxically, if you love your people, whether you're fighting for men's rights, you're fighting for white rights, you're black and you want black rights, whatever, the struggle is at home. Other groups can do nothing against you once you've cleaned out your closet, right? It's like, if we're being replaced, why are we allowing it, right? If we're so naive and just good-hearted that we can't intuit these people that are like subverting our institutions, that's a defect. I'm sorry to say it. You're not fit. You get what you deserve. Everybody gets what they deserve. There's no excuses in nature. So you have to say, okay, well, who are these subversive elements within our, right? Oswald Mosley, he talked about, the British people being denied the right to cull their own, right? Even the soul of which has not been snatched because it has no cash value. It's the problem starts with you. And again, a lot of people sit in these groups and they talk about, oh, we're being replaced. Again, these guys can't go one day without watching porn or whatever. Like they have no free will of their own. You have to take care of things that are in the closest proximity to you and then build on that and scale, right? You cannot just whinge and complain about these other groups that outsmarted you or one-up you or pulled the wool over your eyes. I mean,
what I would say is it's the individualism in whites that made them so weak and vulnerable to this. I'd say it's not that,
sure.
It's not even our empathy. I think our empathy was weaponized after that. I think the first thing was that we were too individualistic in the first place. So we thought, well, we'll just allow these foreigners to into the government and into lobbying and whatever to run our media. because after all, we're all individuals. I think saying this, even 100 years ago, there would have been white people saying this because they were so naive about the realities of group dynamics. And then later individualism in terms of, well, it's good for me to, if I
absolutely so yeah. Absolutely. But again, you interviewed Kevin MacDonald, and I have to go and watch that. But his book, Individualism in the Western Liberal Tradition, in my opinion, it blows culture of critique out of the water. And the idea there that I think he makes a very strong case for is that this individualism paradoxically enabled us to be the weird people, right? The white, educated, industrious, rich, democratic. If you want to be a collectivist in that sense, where you're just dogmatically for your people, then how are you any different than a groid or a poop gook? It's like these people are, you know what I mean? We believed in merit, and we had a society wherein we had smaller families, and our societies were built on what Kevin MacDonald talked about, third-party altruism. We couldn't have done this without that. So how do we address that, right?
Yeah. Well, I've just realized the time, so we're going to have
sure,
to
go yeah.
There is a super chat. I mean, obviously, it's a huge area, and there's a lot to
yeah, do. We could go on for a year. Yeah.
So Bob's Vegana has asked, do you support a BNW-type system of selective breeding with alphas, Brave New World, of course, selective breeding with alphas, deltas, etc.?
Oh, okay. I thought he was talking about something else. Sorry. Brave New World. Yeah, Aldous Huxley was. I'm not trying to be contrarian. I really believe that A Brave New World was a story of hope. I don't think it was a story of despair. If people are happy with their condition, but they lack this like inextricable thing called the free will, and that makes the whole thing mean it. No, people are happy. They're happy. They're contented. They're satisfied. Get over it. So I think that it's an optimistic story. I mean, the answer is yes, for sure.
All right, I thought so. Okay, someone asked me about people. Early on, you mentioned certain unnamed characters who did not even deign to respond to your millennial invitation. Could you perhaps name them? Because I don't want to support them. Those weren't dissident right people. Those were people outside the dissident right that I invited on to millennial in order to spread it around a bit, and they didn't respond. I think everyone within the movement responded, so don't worry about that. Sorry if I said it in some sort of unclear way, so don't worry about that, but thank you for the super chat. Okay, well, let's end it there. So I'll link to your YouTube channel, and your Telegram is there.
Yeah,
I'd recommend you also get onto Odyssey and BitChute. Just have them.
Yeah, I'm working on it.
And then I could link them. So,
yeah. So again, I really want to thank you for what you do. And I was a little bit worried coming on here, but you've been very charitable and open to hear me, which a lot of people aren't. So I do really respect and appreciate what you do, man.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
It is a controversial topic.
Yeah.
Difficult one to approach. I think also a lot of people probably, and this sort of came up in the chat a bit, that this is not something that we need to concern ourselves with just now because we don't have power. And so in that sense, it's sort of academic for a lot of people. But I understand the value of
sure.
The relevance of it. So
right on.
Yeah. And I think other people did in the chat as well. So, okay. Awesome. Well, Collective Dismal.
Yep. Have a good Christmas. Take care. Enjoy the rest of your guests. I'll be watching. Thanks again, and have a good night.
Okay. Thank you.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. Bidding on this year's NFT ends on the 30th. It's your chance to own this one-of-a-kind commemorative piece, lovingly hand-coded by Millennial Woes himself. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. enjoy the journey, and spread the word.